we come to the hall and open to the circulation of Dharma. Receiving it and using it however it seems to be manifesting in the moment. So tonight the topic is the Bodhisattva's great compassionate vows, the four great vows of the Bodhisattva that we chant at the end of talk. We chant them often, and they're kind of like intense vows, you know. It's easy to just get into the habit of chanting and reciting them, but actually they're quite something if we actually listen to what we're saying. So let's explore that a bit. My understanding is that originally these Mahayana Bodhisattva vows appeared in this jewel necklace sutra that also teaches the Bodhisattva precepts. But we know them most through the Platform Sutra of the Sixth Ancestor. We'll get to recite them at the end of tonight's talk. For those who haven't heard these, we usually translate as, beings are numberless. Sentient beings are numberless. I vow to save them. Delusions are inexhaustible. I vow to end them. Dharma gates are boundless. I vow to enter them. Buddha's way is unsurpassable. I vow to become it. So here's the Sixth Ancestor Platform Sutra from ancient China, where seems to be speaking at a kind of repentance ceremony, very similar, it looks like, to the kind we do like tomorrow evening, because it starts with this repentance verse of, like, all my ancient twisted karma. From beginningless greed, hate, and delusion born through body, speech, and mind, I now fully avow, or something like that. And then he says, once you've recited this verse of avowing, revealing, disclosing all our ways that we try to distract ourselves from the present, basically. Then we bring forth these four great universal vows. So Hui Nong, the Sixth Ancestor, says, good friends, once you have repented or revealed, brought forth, and released all your ancient twisted karma in this way, now I will make the four universal vows for you. Each of you, be careful to listen accurately. And I think one version says, like, repeat after me. So this is how we do, like, tomorrow night, one person will recite, and then we all recite back. And it's basically the same thing here, but there's a slight twist in that in this teaching of the sixth Zen ancestor, he says, beings in my own mind are numberless. I vow to save them. And delusions in my own mind are inexhaustible. I vow to end them. Dharma gates in my own nature are boundless. I vow to enter them. Buddha's way in my own nature is unsurpassable. I vow to become it. And then he says, good friends, doesn't everyone say, beings are numberless, I vow to save them? Still, they say this in Santa Cruz even. Amazing. Speaking this way doesn't mean that I'm going to do the saving. Good friends, the beings in the mind are delusion, deception, jealousy, malice. States of mind like this are all beings. Each of you must save yourselves through your own essential nature. This is called true liberation. What is meant by saving, liberating yourself through your own essential nature? That means the beings in false views, afflictions, and ignorance are liberated by accurate insight. Once you have insight, you have wisdom to break through the beings in delusion, so each one is self-liberated. So, it's quite a different take than there's all these numberless beings out there in the world at large, and I vow to save them. You know, it's literally sentient beings are numberless, but we're talking now about sentient beings in my own mind, in each of our own mind. I vow to save or cross them over, is another translation. Cross them over to freedom from entrapment. So, we might feel like, well, this gets us off the hook because there's all those beings out there and that there's so many, we can't really save them anyway. But maybe it doesn't seem so hard to save the ones in my own mind. But if we look closer, we might find that we're on an even bigger hook. I don't know which is really the bigger hook. The beings out there, the beings in here, or the thought about how those might be different. That'd be a third hook to be on. And as far as the beings that seem to be out there, my understanding of how we save them, it's not so much like we might, you know, carry around little pamphlets with the word of Buddha or something and say like, here, sir, may you be saved by the word of Buddha. We usually don't do that. I don't know, maybe somebody tried this. I think it's not like fundamentally the reason we're entrapped on the shore of our limited fixed views is our own delusion, our own obscuration. So we can't really pull beings out of that, but the way we meet them, it seems that we can actually open beings to their Buddha nature. And in the most simplest way, it seems to me that just by meeting them with our own heart as open as possible, in the moment, this fall we're studying this teaching of Dogen called Being Time. So if we meet them, being time means like if we meet them in the way that we're actually coming to be in this moment, with no separation in time or space. Openness, open to the being appearing before us and not knowing who they are or who we are or even what the meeting is. We don't want to go so far as to say that that is saving them, but to me that seems like the best way we can respond to sentient beings, to living beings, to meet them freshly in the moment without knowing really who they are. It's so easy to think we know who they are, but actually not knowing who they are. And in fact, this seems to be quite in accord with saving beings in my own mind, because the beings that are trapped in my own mind are trapped by the belief that I think I know who or what they are. So if I don't know what the beings in my mind are, and I don't know what the beings outside my mind are, and I don't even know if they're outside my mind or not, I don't even know that, to meet them in that way can free them and us and free the whole situation in a way that we might not know, even if we're really in that open space of not knowing, we might not even know how salvation is happening. Salvation's happening in the realm of not knowing. But the Bodhisattva's vow is not just to curl inwards into one's own inner being, forgetting all of these so-called living beings all around us. It's to open outwards and actually meet all. So that's the great compassionate Bodhisattva vow, to save all beings, to free all beings, to cross over all beings, where ultimately the distinction between in my mind and out there is fallen away. So that one comes first. Saving numberless beings. And then the next vow is, we say, delusions are inexhaustible. I vow to end them. So in the Chinese, what we say is delusions is a translation of the other word klesha, which isn't exactly just delusions. It's like sometimes we say negative emotions, afflictive mind states. So classically it said like there's six primary kleshas: greed, hate, confusion, basic three. Greed is like wanting more of what's happening than what's presently happening. Hate is like wanting less of what's happening than what's happening in a kind of extreme way. And confusion is actually not being sure about what's happening, but like having a problem with that. Because we say actually meeting beings without knowing who they are, it might sound like confusion too, but that's an open not knowing. Being confident in the nature of things such that we don't have to know who the person is when we're meeting them. Whereas this kind of confusion is like, I don't know what's going on there, and this may be harmful situation for me, and I should try to get a grip on this somehow even though I can't. That kind of confusion is a little different than intentionally letting go of our fixed way of knowing. Greed, hate, confusion. The other three are pride, which is thinking that we're above others, but also it includes thinking that we're below others. And even in the most subtle way, it includes thinking that we're equal with others. Even that is a very subtle form of pride. It's basically comparison mind, comparing mind. So it's like all of these kleshas, afflictive mind states, all come from this the view that we're an independent self with others out there. They all come from this basic underlying misunderstanding. So pride is like, if I'm feeling weak, having to make myself bigger, but sometimes it's feeling weak and therefore making myself smaller than I really am. But actually, in the realm of equality, there's no like, there's no comparison of beings, actually. We're all just like one flow of life. So when we start ranking ourselves up and down, and this, or even equal, is already like a separation. Greed, hate, confusion, pride, doubt, and doubt about like the practice and the path, and about ourselves and our own ability to practice. And finally, view, false views, which is the basic one, is holding this view of an independent, separate self. And all of these come from this basic, underlying misunderstanding. So it's kind of a nice Dharma list, to know the six primary kleshas, or afflictive mind states, of which there's like many secondary ones that branch out from those. It's kind of nice to know it as a practice tool, to kind of like, even when you're sitting zazen, you can kind of run through these like, I don't feel so settled, I can't really like, something's off in zazen or out of zazen, just in my life. See if you can find one of these six kleshas operating. Might be very not so extreme, as like greed or hate sound very extreme, but just wanting a little more, wanting a little less, being a little confused, being a little above or below, being a little doubtful, and holding a little view, just a little or a lot. So the Buddha likes identifying these kinds of lists, because not to like get into how afflicted our mind is, but more like if we can identify these, then we can actually start working with and see through. Because that's the vow, right? It's actually, you know, kleshas, these afflictions are inexhaustible. They're actually inexhaustible. We sometimes limit them to six, but even if there's just six, they're inexhaustibly six, arising again and again. But I vow to... We say end them. Literally, it's more like cut through them, or I could say cut through is a little bit different than just end. And all these vows are, you know, are boundless, endless, and kind of awesome. But it's a moment-to-moment thing, just like meeting living beings with an open heart is a moment-to-moment thing. Noticing these afflictions and cutting through their solidity. You know, if they're really solid and fixed, like we sometimes feel that they are, I am such a greedy person, how could I ever get over this? Then it's impossible to cut through. But if we see they're like soft butter, even with a dull mind knife, we can just gently slice right through and melt them like into liquid butter, and then drink them as nourishment. The third vow is, Dharma gates are boundless, I vow to enter them. And again, literally, the Chinese doesn't say enter, but it says study or learn. So it's implying Buddha Dharma, like teachings. So we come and hear teachings, and we study teachings, and we find Dharma teachings arising in our own mind, and we learn and study, and it's endless, they're boundless, these gates. So we vow to learn all Dharma, or enter all Dharma gates. We can expand this, not necessarily like Dharma words of the Buddhas and ancestors, but everything all day long can also be a Dharma gate to enter. And Buddha's way is unsurpassable. I vow to become it. Or vow to attain it, become it. Sometimes these four vows are associated with the Four Noble Truths. So like, beings are numberless, suffering beings are numberless, I vow to save them from their suffering, including the ones in my mind, is like the First Noble Truth. And we say, the Buddha said, this suffering must be fully understood. So it could be that the way that we save suffering beings is to fully understand what they are, what a suffering being actually is. And the Buddha said, the origin of suffering is these kleshas, and they must be abandoned. So we say, cut through. And now the third and the fourth are kind of reversed, if you know the Four Noble Truths. The fourth is the path, so that's like, Dharma gates are boundless, I vow to enter them, vow to enter all the practices of the path, goes with that. And the cessation of suffering is also called Nirvana or Buddha, and that's Buddha's way that we vow to become. So in this way, they're bodhisattva vows to practice with these Four Noble Truths. That is Buddha's basic teaching. But as a bodhisattva, this is done particularly to free all beings from suffering. So that's the first vow. And the Buddha's way is unsurpassable. I vow to become it. So I've been bringing up the teaching of Buddha nature periodically, and it's a big topic, so I kind of feel like there's a lot more to say. And in fact, I vow to dedicate the year 2012 to the study of Buddha nature. So as we're planning the classes and so on for this next year, we're looking at various different angles of this teaching of Buddha nature, because there's many angles on it, including Dogen's Zen understanding. So Buddha's way is unsurpassable. I vow to become it is like, Buddha nature is actually unsurpassable. And we are Buddha nature already. So what is this becoming it? Like, we have this great classic Zen story about Matsu, the old Chinese ancestor. Matsu is sitting zazen, and his teacher Nan Yue comes up and says, "Well, what are you doing sitting there?" And he says, "I'm trying to make a Buddha." Matsu says, "Buddha's way is unsurpassable. I vow to become it. That's why I'm sitting here." Isn't that the attitude with which we should sit zazen, is these great bodhisattva vows? And Nanyue picks up a stone roof tile sitting on the ground and with a cloth starts rubbing it, polishing it. And Matsu says, "What are you doing?" He says, "I'm polishing this tile to make a mirror." You know this story. And he says, "Well, how can you polish this like stone, rough stone roof tile to make a mirror? You're going to be at it a long time, aren't you?" And Nanyue said, "Well, how can you make a Buddha by sitting zazen? How are you going to polish this sentient being that's laden with these afflictive mind states into a perfectly purified Buddha, free of all obscurations?" And so Matsu starts doubting his zazen at this point, his mirror polishing zazen. Maybe it's kind of like a fruitless, endless task. And so he says, "Well, then what's the way? What's the way to practice then, Nanyue?" And Nanyue says, "Well, if you have a horse and cart and they don't move, do you prod the horse or prod the cart?" Implying that, if the cart is like Matsu sitting zazen, but what actually is pulling the cart? You know, is it just taking this posture and lining everything up just right, concentrating the mind, but the distractions come up, just concentrate again. Just let them go. They come up, just let them go. They come up, just let them go. They come up, they let them go. This is like over and over again polishing the tile to make a mirror. But Nanyue is saying, "Well, who's actually pulling this cart that's trying to struggling to let go over and over again? Who's pulling this cart?" So to prod it or strike it, strike the puller instead of striking the cart. Sometimes we call that horse that's actually effortlessly pulling us along. Sometimes we call it Buddha nature. And I found this talk by Suzuki Roshi, our San Francisco Zen Center founder. And he's talking about the Buddha, at the Buddha's awakening. This is on December 8th, Rohatsu Day, so he's talking about Buddha's awakening on Buddha's awakening day. And Suzuki Roshi said, "Well, when the Buddha became Buddha under the Bodhi tree, he said, 'It's wonderful to see Buddha nature everywhere and in everyone.' What he meant was, when we practice zazen, we have Buddha nature and we are all Buddha. By practice, he did not mean just to sit under the Bodhi tree or to sit in a cross-legged posture. So he discovered the horse as his cart sat there under the tree. But then he says, our sitting posture is the basic posture though. It's the most fundamental way of being here. But what the Buddha meant actually was that the mountain or trees are, or flowing water or flowers and plants and everything as they are is the way Buddha is. It means everything is taking Buddha's activity in each position and in each way, but the way they are for themselves is not understood by themselves in the realm of consciousness. So there's Matsu sitting there in Zazen, trying to become a Buddha, and he's got his practice program worked out, and he's doing it diligently, just thought arise, let go, thought arise, let go. And but meanwhile, like the water of the rivers flowing by and the trees are just growing and they're dropping their leaves as the light changes effortlessly in accord with conditions, effortlessly. Like that invisible horse that seems to be connected to the old broken down cart. What? So these trees and rivers and so on are not understood by themselves in the realm of consciousness. What we see or what we hear is just a part of or a limited idea of how we are. But when we just sit, we are, he says here, we are being our conception. Now, I don't know, you know, his, these are, this is from 1966, and these are old tapes and stuff, so I wondered, was that really what he meant to say? It was a surprising expression that these things are not understood in the realm of consciousness, but when we sit, we are being our conception. But I thought, if he did mean to say that, it's quite wonderful. In other words, we're not trying to figure out what we're doing with our conception. We're just being our conception. Like if there's a thought arising, we don't use that thought to polish the mirror or to try to figure out what we're doing, but we're just being that thought. I don't know if that's what he meant or not. What we see or what we hear is just a part of or a limited idea of how we are, but when we just sit, we are being our conception. In other words, when we practice something, like when we sit here, there is Buddha's way or Buddha nature. So Buddha's way is unsurpassable. The sitting here, being our conception, is unsurpassable. I vow to become that. So when we ask, what is Buddha nature? When we ask that, Buddha nature vanishes. But when we just practice Zazen like this, we have full understanding of Buddha nature. The only way to obtain Buddha nature or understand Buddha nature is just to practice Zazen or just to be here in this way. What he meant by finding Buddha nature was to be there as he was beyond the realm of consciousness. So it may be said we have originally Buddha nature before we practice Zazen, before we acknowledge it in terms of consciousness. So in this sense, whatever we do, that is Buddha's activity. So if you want to understand it, you cannot understand it. When you give up understanding it, true understanding is there, always. Usually after Zazen, I talk for you. But why you come here is not just to listen to my talk, but to practice Zazen. This point should always be remembered by us. Why I talk this way is to encourage us to practice true Zazen. Buddha nature is always here. And but when we try to figure it out or understand what it is, then we obscure it. It's like our doubting klesha. Very hard not to do this, though. And lastly, I just want to, before we have a little discussion, this is a little discussion with Suzuki Roshi, again, on these four bodhisattva vows. student says, I don't understand these four vows. If there are no sentient beings, why do we vow to save them? It sounds like a big joke. We might think this, we might think that way, that it sounds, you know, there are no beings really, or the beings are in our mind, then it sounds like a big joke. Or we might get, overly serious and think there's too many beings out there to save, like it's a hopeless task, how will we ever help this suffering world? How can we be that open-hearted with everyone? There's some people we just can't be that present and open with. They just activate all our cliches immediately. So, it's not a joke. But in this case he says, it sounds like a big joke, because isn't it true that there aren't really any beings out there? And Suzuki Roshi says, that's because your practice is always confined within the realm of, why do we practice Zazen? What does it mean? Actually, your practice is very good. Why is your practice so good? I don't understand. And he laughs. So he say, this person has this problem that he can't get into these vows because it sounds like a joke and he wants to rationally figure it out. And Suzuki Roshi is saying, your practice is confined in this realm of, quote, why do we practice Zazen? What does it mean? You know, or how do we practice these vows? That's, you're being confined by that. Actually, though, I see your practice is very good without having to do anything particular. But why is it so good? I don't understand. The student says, it doesn't feel so good to me. You can imagine. Suzuki Roshi says, anyway, you're doing well. My lecture may be some enticement. It may be better for you not to listen to my talks. Just practice Zazen. The student says, I don't mind Zazen so much, but I don't like to make promises I don't understand. I don't like to recite those vows that I don't understand. Beings are numberless, I vow to save them. Come on, like, I think it's because he's actually really, he or she is really sincere. Like, and I don't want to just like mouth these words. If I'm going to say that, like, what are we talking about? And I don't feel comfortable doing it. I think we may feel this way. I felt this way about some of the things we do. Can we really do this sincerely? And if we're not doing it sincerely, should we be doing it? Isn't it just kind of faking it? So Roshi says, if sentient beings are numberless or delusions are inexhaustible, you cannot say, I vow to save them. Our promise is very silly. It doesn't make any sense. I agree with you. But still we do it. Why? Because we don't feel so good if we don't work for others. Are there others or not? Well, if we don't work for others in the realm where there seems to be others who are suffering, we don't feel so good. We take the four vows, but what we mean is more than that. For the sake of convenience, we just say the four. But I really truly feel lucky that we have inexhaustible desires, delusions, and numberless sentient beings to save, and also that it's impossible to save each of them in terms of, I save you. You cannot save in that way. So I think that's what the six ancestors are saying too, that the sentient beings are in our mind, is how we have to say them. We have to be careful with that, because then we can get into like, well then, those ones out there. But I think when he says sentient beings are in my mind, it includes what are the ones that appear out there to be suffering. And because we our version of we think we know who they are, we keep them in bondage. So to free them, we have to be free of our ideas of who they are. You cannot save in that way of, I save you. Whether it's possible or not, whether it's the Buddhist or Bodhisattva or Hinayana or Mahayana way, is not the question. Anyhow, do it! That's our vow. And the student says, when I promise to do something, it has to have some meaning. If it doesn't have some meaning, I can't say it. He just keeps arguing. Right? And Suzuki Roshi says, that is your arrogance. That's your arrogance to like try to rationalize this. Isn't that interesting? He's trying to be so sincere, but like, I can't do it if I don't understand the meaning. That's your arrogance. The student says, I don't know, maybe, but... And Suzuki Roshi says, you're crying. Even though you're crying, that crying doesn't make any sense. Your effort is still based on some selfish practice. You don't give yourself up. This is kind of strong here for Suzuki Roshi. He says, you have to suffer and fight more with yourself. But actually, there's no one to fight with and nothing to fight with. Fight with your selfish practice until you give up. So I think he's not saying that you should fight with yourself. He's saying you have to actually fight with yourself until you give up. You have to struggle with these questions until you don't have to struggle with them. I think he's just more saying how it is rather than like you should. Fight with your selfish practice until you give up. That's the most important point for real students. They shouldn't fool themselves. They don't want to be fooled by our teaching or by Zen or by anything. That's right, they shouldn't be fooled by anything. The student says, well, what will I do at the end of the talk when we chant the four vows? Everyone will chant the four vows and I won't believe them. Suzuki Roshi says, you don't have to believe in them literally. Because various teachers and numerous people recite them, you should do it. Now we might say, well, wait a second. But he goes on, if they are cheating themselves, you too should be cheated. You should be fooled along with all sentient beings. Kind of sounds like, you know, all those Zen people just like do those vows, so you should do it too. But then instead of saying, because they really know the way, he's saying, maybe they're all deluded. Doing these, you know, everyone's just kind of mouthing these and just not really, no one really understands it or believes it. But you should, they're all being fooled by Zen, right? But you should be fooled too. If they're cheating themselves, you too should be cheated. You should be fooled along with all sentient beings. That you cannot do it means that you want to be a special person. Like you want to not be fooled. Nobody else really cares about this. They're just ignorantly chanting them, but you want to be like the one who's like, you know, doing the correct, authentic thing. But that's good. That much spirit we should have. But that's not our way. My answer is very cold. I cannot be sympathetic with your practice. Maybe some great teacher will give you some candy. Go and get it. I think sometimes he can be quite strict. Huh? He says, it's not like that, Roshi. Maybe part of it is, but I still don't understand. I don't feel right. Even if the whole world is fooled, if there's something I don't believe in or I don't understand... And Suzuki Roshi says, you don't understand. You see various colors, but how many colors do you see with your eyes? How much sound can you hear? How much can you understand with your small mind? You should know the limit of your thinking mind. Your thinking mind only works dualistically. You have no words to explain this kind of reality. It's almost impossible to understand our teaching through words. But because you stick to my words, or to scriptures, you think the scriptures should be perfect, should be more convincing, and should make sense. You should think in that way, but I must confess that what I say is not always right, not always true. I'm suggesting something more than that. Not only Buddha, but Confucius also said, if someone wants to fool you, you should be fooled by them. That is very important. Kind of unusual commentary on the four vows. This is Branching Streams, Flow in the Darkness. It's his talks on the Sandokai. So there's a little divergence from the talk. So, Yes.
I rise in defense of doubt.
What's that?
I rise in defense of doubt.
You rise in defense of doubt.
Yeah. Mm. Because you talked about doubt as a kalisha, kind of a hindrance, but there's another kind of doubt that softens my certainty.
I think that's true. There's two kinds of doubt.
It says, maybe not so.
Mm-hmm.
And then there's the doubt that doubts doubt,
mm-hmm.
which creates certainty. This is the way it is.
Yeah.
And are we not talking about the kind of cynical negativity that says, this is right, that isn't?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so sometimes we use the word corrosive doubt.
Yeah.
Corrosive doubt that wears away our enthusiasm for practice and our trust in the immediacy of the way. And then, like Hakuin Zenji says, the three, necessary pillars of Zen practice are great doubt, great faith, which sounds like the opposite, and great determination.
I would put great doubt and great faith as the same thing.
Mm. The way he talks about it is like, you start with great faith, faith in Buddha nature, actually. You trust, you have this great trust. You heard these teachings and you know it on some deep level. You really trust all being is Buddha nature. And then the doubt is, but what about this klesha mind? Could this really be it? Or even if we've heard that the fundamental affliction of ignorance is itself the immutable knowledge of all Buddhas, still, probably at least a little doubt arises. Well, really? Especially if we're really caught up in it. So I think, that kind of doubt is fuel for practice. The doubt of like, but how could this be? How could this be? That's our fuel. But the corrosive doubt is like, I doubt that I can actually continue this practice. That's the corrosive kind. So, the doubt of like, I don't know mind, like, who is this person facing me, is very helpful, even like close to
yes.
Buddha mind.
When we doubt the don't know mind, then we are making certainty.
Hmm.
And that, and criteria, right here.
Mm-hmm.
This is it, rather than just thus.
Mm-hmm.
I think when the thusness becomes thisness is a problem. So I look at doubting doubt as a problem, but simply doubting and opening my mind as a virtue.
We have a wonderful section coming up in Dogen's Being Time essay about doubt. He actually brings up the issue of doubt and without skipping ahead there, basically it comes down to like doubt is a complete expression of being time, mm-hmm. and doubt about how could this be the time being is itself the time being. Mm-hmm. So and Dogen says similar things about doubt in other places too. Maybe it was something he was working with. Or it's like for a practitioner, that's maybe one of the last things of like to really get caught by is shouldn't I be like doubt free if I'm really in accord with reality? But to see that actually doubt itself is just another time being expression of Buddha nature. Yes.
Well, I think that's what the vows are helpful to recognize. What I mean is, there's something for me profoundly liberating in the message, the underlying message of all those vows, which is some version of, I know it seems impossible, but I'm going to do it anyhow. I know it seems hard, but I'm going to do it anyhow. Because I think part of where the corrosive doubt comes in is that we try to, well, because this isn't perfect,
mm-hmm.
because you're not perfect, or because whatever. We have so many
mm-hmm.
rationales that we use for not just surrendering to the moment and to being with each other in the moment.
Yeah.
And the it's almost like maybe it's the faith, the great faith of the vow, these vows, is it's not about having all the answers. It's not about being perfect. It's not about having it all figured out. Like the guy, I love the dialogue with the student. You know, he's or she is really trying to, but I have to get it. It's like, forget it. You're never going to get it. That's the whole point of the vow. It's endless.
Mm-hmm.
You're not going to get it. But does that stop you? Then no. That's the beauty of it for me, is that the vow is bigger than the limiting factors.
Yep. Yeah, it's we can never actually, if we have a perfectionist view, we'll just get totally discouraged and just have to give up. But if we see that it's impossible, so it's maybe they're designed in this very way that because they're actually so impossible, that keeps us from thinking, oh, maybe I'm actually doing it. Maybe I have saved all beings.
Yeah, I feel like it always kind of blows apart the sort of sense of duality.
Mm-hmm.
You know, of you and them and impossible versus possible.
Mm-hmm.
And so it does always put you in that very kind of like sort of free fall.
Mm-hmm.
You just jump in and you don't really know what it means, but it's that process of just opening to that possibility.
Yeah.
Whatever.
Yeah.
Way it manifests moment to moment. So.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I loved it in those vows.
Yeah, there's no... If we go to the other extreme of, well, maybe they are all complete from the beginning, you know, from the ultimate point of view, all beings are saved, all delusions are ended, ultimately, right? All dharma gates are entered right now, and Buddha's way is realized. Kind of like from the point of view of Buddha nature, they're all completely complete from the beginning.
Mm-hmm.
So if we fall into that extreme and say, well, then that's so silly and dualistic to say, like, I'm going to do these impossible things. That's all the more reason then to do it.
Mm-hmm.
Suzuki Roshi says, just do it. And it's the spirit of kind of, I think that's how we... another one of our chances, like a fool, like an idiot, just to continue in this way, this foolish way of just vowing to do the impossible, is the spirit of practice. That's what gives us life, without falling into the extreme of there's nothing to do, or the extreme of it's impossible, you know. There's nothing to do, so let's not do anything. Or it's too much to do, let's not do anything. It's the middle way of let's do it. May our intention equally extend to every being and place with the true merit of Buddha's way. Beings are numberless. I vow to save them. Delusions are inexhaustible. I vow to end them. Dharma gates are boundless. I vow to enter them. Buddha's way is unsurpassable. I vow to become it.